From VOA, Press Conference USA, here is your host, Carol Castillo.
Welcome to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. I'm your host, Carol Castiel. Our special guest on this edition of the program is Ambassador Bill Taylor, former U.S. envoy to Ukraine, currently Vice President for Strategic Stability and Security at the U.S. Institute of Peace. Our topic, what are Russia's real motivations for massing 100,000 troops along the border with Ukraine? What are prospects for a de-escalation of the crisis? The subject of intense talks last week in Brussels, Geneva, and Vienna among NATO allies, Ukraine, and Russia. On the Russian-Ukraine conundrum, VOA's Jamie Detmer writes, quote, Western policymakers remain as puzzled now as their predecessors were on the eve of the Cold War 40 years ago about Russia's geopolitical intentions. Is the Kremlin preparing to launch an invasion of its neighbor Ukraine, which increasingly sees itself as part of the West, if sweeping security guarantees Moscow has demanded are rebuffed? Or is the ominous Russian military buildup along Ukraine's borders an exercise in brinksmanship, a maneuver by President Vladimir Putin to try to wring more concessions than he otherwise would from the United States and European allies at the negotiating table? That is the key question. Detmer goes on to say that the Kremlin has demanded that NATO pledge never to admit Ukraine as a member and that the Western alliance withdraw any military presence from the former Soviet satellite countries of Central Europe and to de-escalate the crisis over Ukraine. Such ultimatums are non-starters for the United States and most NATO and European allies. Bilateral U.S.-Russian talks in Geneva on Monday were followed by Russia-NATO Council negotiations in Brussels and a meeting in Vienna of the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe, a body that includes Russia, Ukraine, and all NATO countries. So after a week of high-stakes diplomacy, what can we conclude? Jamie Detmer says, quote, will Putin settle for anything less than a revanchist turning the clock back to when Moscow controlled half of Europe? Detmer quotes Andrew Marshall of the Atlantic Council, who says, quote, the outcome of this dispute could decisively rewrite the terms of security on the European continent for an entire generation, just as the decisions of the 1990s did after the end of the Cold War, closed quote. Well, we will talk with Ambassador Taylor about all of this and even why Kazakhstan allowed a Russian-led security force to enter the country to quell a wave of political unrest triggered initially by frustration over high fuel prices that left dozens dead and thousands injured. Ambassador Bill Taylor joins us via Microsoft Teams. Welcome to the program.
Carol, it's great to be here. Thank you very much for having me.
Well, it's a pleasure to have you, one of the foremost experts. Well, Bill Taylor, I think given my introduction, we have a lot to talk about. Let me get you to respond regarding what do you think are Russian designs? Is it a way to somehow reorder the architecture of European security by massing troops at the Ukrainian border, threatening invasion? Is it just a bluff? How do you see it?
Carol, I see this as a very dangerous time, where, as you say, Mr. Putin has assembled on the Ukrainian borders a large military force that is capable of doing horrible things, capable of undertaking war. We're talking about war in the middle of Europe. This war, of course, has been going on at a lower level for the past 8 years since he invaded the first time, first in Crimea and then in Donbas. But he's now threatening to do it again on a larger scale. And you asked the right question. What's behind this? We don't know what's behind this. No one knows what's in Mr. Putin's mind, and that's probably the only place to answer that question. What is he planning to do? Maybe he hasn't decided yet, and maybe he is building up his options, developing his options, and he's got some options. It is likely that he would like to achieve some goals, and we can talk about these goals, without an invasion. He is probable that he would like to achieve his desired outcomes by intimidating President Zelensky in Kyiv or President Biden in Washington or the NATO alliance in Brussels. Maybe President Putin thinks by massing these troops, he can intimidate people, these presidents, these organizations, into giving him what he wants. So far, he has not succeeded. So far, the United States, in the first instance, And then earlier this week in Brussels, all of NATO has rejected his claims, has rejected out of hand, clearly, dismissively, his demands for ironclad assurances that Ukraine will never join NATO. It's been a total rebuff of President Putin's demands. And he and his spokespeople are expressing frustration. They can't believe that the United States has been so firm in rejecting these demands, or that NATO has been so unified in rejecting these demands, and that President Zelensky has been so solid and has not backed down at all. So President Putin probably hoped that by building up these forces, threatening major warfare, that he would get what he wants, and he has failed so far. What does he want? Again, no one knows what's in his head. He's made some things very clear, however. He's made it clear that he cares a lot about Ukraine. He's made it clear he doesn't think Ukraine's a real country. He thinks Ukraine's really just part of Russia. He doesn't recognize that Ukraine is a sovereign, independent country with a culture and a language and a history that goes back, he will be sad to remember. The Ukrainian history goes back well beyond Russian history. Ukrainian history goes all the way back to Kievan Rus in Kiev, back when St. Sophia was built, in the origins of the Slavic Christian culture and history, back in the 10th, 11th centuries. And at that time, Carol, as you know, and probably all of your listeners know, when the Ukrainians of that day built St. Sophia's in the heart of Kiev, Moscow was a forest. There was no Russia. So that bothers President Putin. And he wants to reclaim that history. He wants to reclaim that culture. He wants to reclaim the Christian Slavic background of Russia, but it belongs to Ukraine. And the Ukrainians have stood up and are standing up, and the United States is standing up to this pressure that President Putin is putting on, and I hope it continues.
Well, thank you very much for that, Mr. Ambassador. Mr. Putin does seem to like to engage in disinformation and gaslighting, not just with respect to the interpretation of Ukraine as a real sovereign country, trying to say that somehow it's really not, as you stated, but also in the way he has framed this crisis as if it's the fault of the West and Ukraine for taking defensive measures against Russia, which has been massing tens of thousands of troops on Ukraine's border. I don't know if he thinks that people are going to forget that Moscow invaded Ukraine in 2014, illegally annexed Crimea, and then stirred up conflict in eastern Ukraine in the Donbass region, which still continues. At any rate, he continues this false narrative, and I guess some people are buying it, but hopefully, and as you said, the West, much to his great dismay, has stood rather firm, because democracies have a way of free speech and differing interests could be somehow be divided, but they have stood firm, as you said, which is a good thing, but now what? We know that some of the goals are non-starters, that NATO has to pledge to never allow Ukraine membership in NATO or Georgia, and that NATO troops are supposed to move back to pre-1997 boundaries, as if, you know, we're supposed to ignore all these geostrategic changes in the continent. So insofar as those goals cannot be achieved, what are U.S., EU, and NATO counteroffers, and can any of them mollify Putin short of these non-starters?
Well, you're right, Carol. The United States, Ukraine, Europeans are not going to offer concessions. They're not going to appease. They're not even going to try to appease President Putin. They're not going to accommodate his absurd demands. I mean, you just outlined them. They are absurd demands, and they've been rejected as such. That's not going to change. President Putin slapped down a couple of draft treaties back in December, middle of December, and some of these absurd demands are in those treaties. However, there are a couple of interesting questions, ideas in those treaties that might be worth pursuing in order to make Ukraine better off, in order to make NATO more secure, in order to improve security of the United States. There are a couple of things in there that we could benefit from. One would be the removal of intermediate range nuclear weapons from Kaliningrad or from other parts of European Russia where they threaten the United States, Europe, and Ukraine. So we could benefit from removing those intermediate range missiles, and we'd be willing to have the conversation about a reciprocal move on the NATO side. We'd be willing to have that conversation. We recall that there was an intermediate range nuclear force treaty, the INF treaty, that the Russians violated, which led to withdrawal. Both sides have now withdrawn from the INF treaty, but the INF treaty provided some stability, security, while it was in force. And when the Russians violated it, it stopped providing that security and stability. But we could try to return to that. There could be, it's not return to that treaty. There are many differences today from when they originally negotiated that treaty. But the idea of moving intermediate range nuclear forces away from borders, out of strike range, maybe out of Europe, is definitely worth a conversation. It's worth discussing. So that's one. There's another issue that would make NATO better off, make Ukraine better off, make the United States better off. And that is, if we had more insight, if we had more information, if we had more transparency about military maneuvers that the Russians are carrying out. For example, the Russians continue to say, obviously falsely, that all these troops that are on all three borders of Ukraine right now are there for military exercises, and no one should be concerned about military exercises on their own territory. They have the ability, the authority, to move forces around their own territory without bothering anyone. Ludicrous. What we would like to know, in advance, we'd like to know if there are going to be some military exercises. B, we'd like to know how big they are. C, we'd like to know where they're going to be. And D, we'd like to observe them. We'd like to go be there and see if they are abiding by the agreements that they put up to. And if they're willing to give us that kind of access and notification and observation and transparency, then NATO would be willing to do the same thing. We had a conventional forces in Europe treaty, CFE treaty, in the previous time. It's not in effect anymore. But we could have that idea. That treaty provided at the time, that was actually negotiated with the Soviets, and then tried to be updated with the Russians. The Russians didn't agree. They maintained their forces in Moldova and Georgia, so that didn't work. But if they were willing, the Russians were willing to have this conversation about transparency about military exercises in Russia, we'd be willing to have that same conversation about military exercises, transparency in NATO. That could benefit us. And that's what we'd be after. It would benefit us. It would benefit Ukraine. It would benefit NATO.
Right.
If the Russians are interested, we're interested in talking.
Okay. Well, somehow reciprocity, win-win situations don't seem to be the language that Mr. Putin understands for the most part. But nonetheless, we'll have more in just a moment. You're listening to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Our guest is Ambassador Bill Taylor, former U.S. Ambassador to Ukraine, now Vice President at the U.S. Institute of Peace. I'm Carol Castiel, and this is a reminder that our PCUSA podcast is available on our website at voanews.com/PCUSA. And you may also follow us on Twitter or connect with us on Facebook at Carol Castiel VOA. You may also send us an email to PCUSA@voanews.com. We'd love to hear from you. Well, back to our special guest, Ambassador Taylor, because Ambassador, so much to talk about. Here's a question with regard to, you know, Russia in terms of its strength or weakness. I've heard some analysts say that Mr. Putin is in a position of strength, that we're the ones, that is the West, are in a position of relative weakness. But I'd like to get your view. Is it possible that Putin is actually fearful of a democratizing Ukraine along its border that might influence democracy activists in Russia? Is he causing chaos, rattling sabers out of fear rather than strength, which actually could make him more dangerous?
Carol, you are absolutely right. Putin is worried. Mr. Putin might even be desperate. He may recognize, he may have concluded correctly, the time is not on his side. He, as I mentioned earlier, may be thinking, who knows what's really in his head, but he may be thinking that he wants to try to pull Ukraine back into his control, back into Russia, because in his view, Ukraine's not a real country. So it's to pull it back in. We've rejected that. The Ukrainians have rejected that. But every day that goes by, every week that goes by, every year that goes by, Ukraine moves farther and farther away from Russia and more into Europe, into European institutions, into European markets, into European culture, into European standards. Every minute that goes by, every new generation that comes along in Ukraine is more and more oriented towards Europe and less oriented towards Russia. So time's not on his side in that regard. That's number one. Time's not on his side either for him. I mean, again, if he wants to be this grand historical Russian leader in the same way that Catherine the Great or Peter the Great, or he may think that Stalin was a great leader. Other people have different views about Joseph Stalin, but it seems to be that Mr. Putin would like, if he wants to be in that category of Russian leaders, he needs Ukraine. He wants to regather the lands. He wants to pull back the lands, in particular Ukraine, that were lost when the Soviet Union disappeared. And he's 69. He may be running out of time. Now, he's got plenty of time on as being president. He's already changed the Constitution so that he can stay in the presidency until 2036. But he's running out of time on that. A third way he's running out of time, actually, goes back to the first point. As Ukraine moves more and more towards Europe, it gets stronger and stronger. Ukraine's military has gained great strength since Mr. Putin invaded in 2014. The Ukrainian military today is much stronger, is much better led, has higher morale, is better trained, has better equipment, has weapons coming from both the international community and the United States, but also from its own factories. Ukraine is getting stronger and stronger militarily every day. At times not on his side in that regard either. A fourth way that time's not on Mr. Putin's side is his economy. His economy is not strong. His economy is fragile. He's facing dramatic sanctions that will weaken him seriously. He knows this. In his conversation with President Biden, President Putin said, if you put sanctions on me for invading Ukraine, it will disrupt our relations for generations. He's worried about those sanctions, as he should be.
Yeah. What are those sanctions, if you wouldn't mind elaborating on them or delineating them for us?
Those sanctions are a broad range of measures that the United States, in the first instance, but Europeans as well, and not just U.S. And Europeans, but also the Japanese and the Australians, all of NATO, including Canada. So there is a broad coalition. EU, G7, all have committed to imposing these strict sanctions on him. And what are we talking about strict sanctions? Well, a couple of things. One is there would be restrictions on the ability for Russian enterprises, Russian finance ministers and financiers, people who CEOs, to get investment from abroad. Investment from abroad would be cut off. In addition, there has been talk about sanctioning big banks. Not the smaller banks that have been sanctioned in the past, but large banks that would affect a large portion of the Russian economy. There are sanctions that we could put on and are planning to put on people around President Putin. There are people around President Putin who give him advice, and they have a lot of their assets in London or in Miami or in New York. Those assets can and will be frozen. Those same people would like to be able to travel to Europe and to the United States. And their families, their wives and children would like to travel to the United States and to Europe. Cut off. These sanctions could be imposed and will be imposed on these people who are right around President Putin. It will hurt them. It will hurt them. We're also talking about export controls. That is, we would cut off exports of high-tech equipment, microchips, computer chips that the Russians need in order to manufacture their weapons, but also to manufacture their smartphones. So these sanctions are very serious. The ultimate sanction, which is on the table, is to cut the entire Russian banking system, finance system, off from the international banking network, the so-called SWIFT.
Yes.
And that's on the table. None of these, Carol, are cost-free. They will be painful. The main pain that these will cost are on Russians. The burden of these sanctions will be on Russia.
That raises this question. So these punishing economic sanctions, do you think they, in fact, raise the costs for Putin with regard to an incursion into Ukraine? Did they really give him pause? I mean, this last week of whirlwind meetings may not have made any breakthroughs, but the question is, you know, what is the likelihood of conflict? And then could that conflict be averted by the imposition or just the threat of these sanctions? And do you see the West, you know, the NATO, EU, and the United States united in imposing them at the site or the action of any kind of hybrid or actual warfare by Russia?
The United States has led a very strong effort, has consulted, has negotiated, has coordinated with all the allies you just mentioned in Europe and around the world. The consultations that the United States government has undertaken is almost unprecedented in terms of the number of phone calls, discussions, visits, coordinating sessions on these sanctions. We haven't seen that. It's just unprecedented. And yes, I believe that all of that has led to a commitment, and you hear it stated by the European Union, you hear it stated by the G7, you certainly hear it stated by the Americans, that we will impose these sanctions when and if Mr. Putin makes the bad decision to invade Ukraine. Now, you raised a question about, you know, there are hybrid measures he could take. Maybe he does a cyber attack on Ukraine, which he's done before. He's done a cyber attack on the United States. We know how to respond to cyber attacks, and Ukrainians know how to respond. We know where those cyber attacks come from. We can respond to those as well. So there are a lot of measures that we have at our disposal to respond to every level of provocation, of threat, of attack, of aggression that Mr. Putin has.
And you're not worried that Putin could exploit any potential cracks within the alliance?
I'm not worried, not a bit. I think he's probably worried that we will continue to be solid. He must have observed very carefully the response earlier this week at NATO in Brussels. He undoubtedly observed the determination that Deputy Secretary Wendy Sherman had in her voice when she dismissed those demands that we talked about that are just absurd. Mr. Putin will have noticed that there is a strong coalition against him. And he will have noticed that there's a commitment to put these sanctions on in different ways by different people who have different relationships with Russia, and they can hurt him in different ways. And they will do that. We will do that. And Mr. Putin has to worry. Carol, one thing that we haven't talked about is Mr. Putin being weak, being concerned about a successful Ukraine, being seen by Russians as being successful and part of European institutions. Mr. Putin does not want to see that. He doesn't want Russians to see that. Russians will say, why not us? But the other question that I've got that leads me to believe that Mr. Putin is weaker than he thinks is that it sounds to me like the Russian people are not hostile to Ukraine. It sounds to me like what Mr. Putin is threatening to invade a neighbor that many Russians think of as brothers. Mr. Putin is doing this. Why? Why is he going to kill a lot of Russian soldiers and Ukrainian soldiers and Ukrainian civilians? But why is he going to cause all this damage? Why is he going to cause this major catastrophe for his own ego? Because he wants to be seen as a great Russian leader? That's why he's going to kill all these Russian soldiers? I don't think that's going to be very popular with Russian people. I don't think that they're going to like seeing their brothers and fathers and sons and sisters and mothers coming back dead from a war against what a lot of Russians, certainly a lot of younger Russians, think of as friendly nation. What's the problem living with a peaceful Ukraine? I mean, they live with a peaceful Baltics. They live with a peaceful Poland. Why does Mr. Putin have to invade? I think he's not answered that question. He doesn't have a good answer to that question. If it's just about his ego, that's not a good answer.
That's right. And as you said, whether it's the punishing economic sanctions that the West would impose or the reaction of his own population, it's not risk-free. You know, body bags coming back from Ukraine, like you said, that's not going to be popular. I don't think, as you said, the population would be behind him. So there are more risks perhaps than he has considered with respect to his buildup along the border and threats. So
I think that's right, Carol. I think he does have military advantage. There's no doubt that his military is bigger than the Ukrainian military. Ukrainian military is stronger than it was in 2014, a lot stronger, has a lot more weapons, has a lot more capability to inflict real damage on the Russian military. But the Russian military is big, and he has that advantage, but he doesn't have overall advantage. In the end, the unity of the alliance and the alliances against him and the economics and the military support will mean that he'll lose. In the end, he will lose if he invades Ukraine for all kinds of reasons. The Ukrainians will fight hard. The military will fight hard. The civilians will fight hard. They'll be fighting in the streets and in the villages. Ukrainians will fight very hard. In the end, Putin will lose.
And quickly, as we close, Mr. Ambassador, as we close this week of talks, where do you see things going? Do you see talks continuing? Has the risk of conflict increased or lessened? What should we be looking at over the next couple of weeks?
Over the next couple of weeks, indeed, probably the next couple of days, within the next week or so, the Russians are going to have to make a decision on which way they go. And indeed, Mr. Putin, I guess, is the Russian decision maker. So he'll have to decide if he wants to pursue these ideas that we talked about. There are some good negotiations that make sense, that would make us better off, but would also make the Russians better off. There are those kinds of conversations, negotiations that ought to take place, in my view, and in the view of the NATO alliance. Probably most of Europe would think those kinds of conversations on INF, on CFE, would be the way to go. That would address these issues. But he may decide that, nope, he wants to invade Ukraine for all the reasons that we talked about earlier. In my view, that would be a mistake. He would, in the end, lose. But those are the two paths.
And Mr. Ambassador, one last question with regard to Kazakhstan. We just saw an uprising in Kazakhstan, presumably due to rising fuel prices. It caused lots of political unrest. And of course, we know that a Russian-led security force from the Collective Treaty Security Organization, it's a NATO-like group, but it includes Russia and five other former Soviet states, came in. They're leaving now. Do you see any connection between what happened in Kazakhstan and what we're seeing with respect to Russia trying to assert itself and prevent any type of so-called color revolution or move to more autonomy, democracy, with respect to Kazakhstan?
Mr. Putin, as you say, Carol, does not like color revolutions. He didn't like to see the Orange Revolution in Ukraine. He didn't like to see the revolution in Georgia. There have been other revolutions that have occurred that he's really not liked. And he didn't think that he had to worry about a color revolution in Kazakhstan. But it turns out that that form of government doesn't work. That form of government, an autocracy, does not work. And people get upset and people get irritated and people go to the streets. And they did. This was not just about fuel prices. This was about something much bigger.
Indeed, so much inequality of wealth and the repression of voices. So we shall see, but that was a very interesting development. Ambassador Bill Taylor is former ambassador to Ukraine. He's now vice president at the U.S. Institute of Peace. Ambassador Taylor, thank you so much for your time and terrific insights.
Carol, thank you very much for having me. It's been a great conversation. Thank you.
Press Conference USA on the Voice of America was produced in Washington with technical assistance from Rick Pantaleo. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.